The 100 Years' War, the De Guesclin period, the situation in Bordeaux and Cherbourg. At the time of the Siege of Cherbourg, there was still a large number of Navarrese in the garrison, as well as some of Charles of Navarre's Norman retainers. But the Norman soldiers were ambivalent about the English occupation, and almost all the Navarrese returned to Navarre with Charlotte de Beaumont early in 1379. They were replaced by Englishmen, rubbing shoulders with a population that remained almost entirely French. Charles V commanded all of his subjects in Cherbourg to withdraw after the arrival of the English or be treated as traitors. A few of them complied, adding to the number of empty shops and abandoned houses in what was once a thriving commercial port. But most of the inhabitants had nowhere else to go. They stayed as long as they could, still making a living. They reached an unheroic but workable compromise with the English captains. They received guarantees for their possessions and limited commercial privileges in England. They negotiated terms for the billeting of soldiers in their houses, always a delicate problem in a garrison town. They submitted to a modest duty on wine, which was certainly less onerous than the taxes they would have paid to the King of France. They did watch duties from the English captains, just as they had done for Charles of Navarre. How much of Cherbourg contributed to England's war effort was a controversial question even at the time. The English government thought well enough of the place to hang on to it until 1394. It became a staging post for English naval operations in the Channel and a base for mounted raids in France. It also tied down French forces who would have otherwise been available for service on other fronts. But Cherbourg never fulfilled its promise as a point of entry into France, any more than Brest did, in spite of being larger and closer to England. Its defense was extremely expensive. For the first 18 months of the occupation, the garrison was maintained by 560 men, and more than twice the garrison of Brest. In addition to their wages, there was the regular drain of money to pay for building works and repairs, food and equipment, most of which had to come from England, and for the ships and crews which were constantly employed in ferrying goods and men to and from and across the Channel. In the first year after the end of the siege, Cherbourg cost the English government about £10,000. Thereafter, the garrison was reduced and the cost fell to about £8,000 a year until the end of 1382, when dramatic reductions were achieved by putting captains in the fixed-priced contracts. The profits of Cherbourg went into the captains' pockets. They must have made even larger profits than those of Brest, for the loot of the Atlantic sea lanes was just as plentiful, and the Cantine was a richer region than Finistre. Although there are no figures for the profits at Brest, their value can be judged from the fact that Sir Hugh Calverley, one of the shrewdest military entrepreneurs of his day, at one point agreed to take Cherbourg's contract at 5,700 marks, £3,800 for a year, less than half of what the government had been paying to defend the town. In 1386, after complaints in Parliament about the cost of England's continental barbicans, it was successfully let out for just £2,000 a year. As at Brest, these contracts were essentially financial transactions. The prominent public figures who obtained them rarely, if ever, commanded the defense in person. They took the profits, sometimes paid their men, and performed their duties through deputies. Now, Sir John Neville's fleet, carrying the new lieutenant, 560 English troops at £6,000 in cash, arrived off Bordeaux on September the 7th, 1378, as the bells of the city's churches were ringing for Vespers. Neville found the duchy in a state of exhausted stalemate. Since the capture of Sir Thomas Felton the year before, the king's affairs in Bordeaux had been in the hands of a caretaker administration, in which the leading figure was acting seneschal Sir Matthew Gournay. Gournay was a professional soldier with more than 30 years' experience of fighting in France, who had been at every great battle of the previous reign, from Sluis to Najara. Since his main center of operations was the southern city of Dax, his direction of business must have been remote. But there was, in any event, little for the administration to do. Much of its staff had been laid off for want of funds. Military expenditure was reduced to keeping skeleton garrisons in a handful of walled towns and paying modest subsidies to help territorial lords of the Bordelais to defend their own. The few military operations undertaken by the Anglo-Gascons had been essentially private enterprises, funded by loot, in other words. The citizens of Bordeaux, who had been told that the government could do nothing for them, were obliged to organize their own defense. They did it with verve and some success. At the end of June 1378, they had launched a remarkable campaign of their own against the French garrisons along the Garonne River, which resulted in the recovery of the fortress town of Lagon. Further east, a group of lords of the Angenais, led by Guillard d'Erfurt, Lord of Duras, even reoccupied the citadel, the cathedral city of Bazeille. But Gascony owed its survival mainly to the distractions of the Duke of Anjou, and we'll be looking into that next time. Now, the sources for this: The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.